Hey, hey, welcome back to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. I'm your host, Cedric Youngelman. This episode is brought to you by Microseed. Microseed makes your self-custody effortless and unbreakable. Stamp your seed phrase so tiny, it's practically invisible to the naked eye. Zero hassle, maximum peace of mind. Grab your kit at microseed.io with code MATRIX for a sweet discount. Ditch your fiat health insurance like my family did. Join us at CrowdHealth. Use code MATRIX at joincrowdhealth.com to get your first 3 months at $99 each. Collaborative custody, multi-sig vaults, Bitcoin loans and IRAs at Onchained. Get 10% off using code MATRIX10 or go to onchain.com/matrix to get your self-custody in order. Start sacking sats the right way at River. Up to $100 in free Bitcoin. Visit river.com/matrix to learn more. If you're into infinite banking but don't want to sell your Bitcoin, you need to know about Meanwhile. They offer the world's first regulated Bitcoin life insurance, letting you store, borrow against, and pass on your Bitcoin. Head to meanwhile.bm and use code YTPFYD to learn more. Today, I'm sitting down with Joe Burnett for the fourth time to discuss his piece, The Singularity Has Begun. And this might just be our most important conversation yet. Joe makes a bold case. As intelligence becomes abundant and essentially free, wealth itself starts to melt. When AI models write their own code and you can spin up a trillion Albert Einsteins on demand, what happens to your savings, your assets, everything you've worked for? We're diving into why diversification feels prudent but leaves people hopeless. Why meme coins and sports betting surge when traditional savings feel fragile. And why Bitcoin sits at this unique intersection at what Joe calls a terminal discovery. Something that, like the number zero or a perfect circle, simply can't be improved upon. We'll also tackle some uncomfortable questions. Can AI agents become truly autonomous? What happens when your AI refuses to give you back your seed phrase? And is there really only one asset that abundant intelligence can't dilute? This goes deep into scarcity, abundance, money, and what it means to preserve wealth in a world being fundamentally reshaped by intelligence itself. If you're vibing with the show, like, subscribe, drop a 5-star review, and share it with your friends and family. Get early ad-free episodes on Fountain. Grab merchandise or hit me up at thebitcoinmatrix.com. Shout out to this incredible community and to our sponsors and affiliates. I only partner with brands I actually use and trust. Support our sponsors and affiliates. Keep the Bitcoin Matrix independent. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with my friend Joe Burnett.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Joe Burnett, welcome back to the Bitcoin Matrix for the fourth time. How are you?
Hey, Cedric. Thanks for having me on. I'm doing great.
Yeah, man. It's been a minute. I think almost a year, maybe, since we last spoke. We dropped this piece, The Singularity Has Begun, and I wanted to kind of reach out and talk about it. I'm sure we could talk about maybe the markets and some of the volatility we've been experiencing, but this was interesting. The Singularity Has Begun. What inspired you to write this piece?
A few things inspired me to write The Singularity Has Begun. One, and kind of jokingly, Twitter did that $1 million X competition, X article competition. So, wanted to throw my hat in the ring there to see if I can win. Unfortunately, did not win. Did get, 400 plus thousand impressions or views. So it did well, but needed maybe 40 million views, unfortunately. But I wrote it partially because, and you brought this up in the intro, I wrote a report titled Your Wealth is Melting, which was very similar to kind of what I published in The Singularity Has Begun, but it was expanded, and I published it, Your Wealth is Melting, I think around spring of 2024, so it's been a while. And now with AI really catching on, and Claude, ClaudeBot, or now OpenClaw, and NVIDIA doing so well, and Anthropic and OpenAI and so on and so forth, people are really starting to catch on that things are changing in a really big way. Elon has even mentioned that he thinks the quote-unquote singularity has begun in some shape or form. And so I thought that it would be a good idea to kind of reposition how I think Bitcoin fits into this world where technology is really starting to advance at a truly unprecedented pace, and kind of what it means for so many different things. So happy to be talking about it.
All right. Well, there's a lot to unpack there. What is the singularity?
To me, well, there's multiple, there's different definitions for the word. But in my mind, it's like, it's this idea that humanity is becoming incredibly advanced, and we're all kind of like converging towards one thing that, you know, you don't necessarily even know what it is. And it's kind of like a tipping point, like a black hole, where it's like, okay, it's this, you know, center of mass where you don't actually really know what's on the other side of it, anything. And so I think like with AI, it's advancing everything so rapidly that it's going to be a very positive feedback loop into how fast everything accelerates, right? Like, yeah, you have the humanoid robots, which, you know, could start building other humanoid robots. You have AI that can start designing more AI models. And so it kind of becomes this like circular positive feedback loop that really just takes you, once the robots start building the robots and the AI start building the AIs, it kind of takes you into this black hole of technology advancement that we don't necessarily even know what it is. And as you get closer to this horizon or the singularity, it accelerates faster and faster. And you know, perhaps it's something that has started.
Do you think it's already begun, the singularity?
You know, it depends on how you define it. I would say yes. I mean, I think that, you know, like AI models, I think I saw like Anthropic or someone that worked at Anthropic has mentioned that the last, I guess, Opus like 4.6 or whatever it was mainly built by itself. You know, a lot of the code was built by itself. And then I think like Claude Cowork, it was like entirely built by, like all of the code was written by Claude itself. And so it's like, it's starting to get in this, you know, circular positive feedback loop where the AIs are actually starting to build the AIs. And that's going to possibly have, you know, massive implications. And if it started, you know, things can move, you know, mind-bogglingly fast to a normal person.
What does it mean to go from scarce intelligence to abundant intelligence?
So, you know, I think like if you look back over, you know, the last 200 years, like another people have kind of talked about like this, what's happened in the past, really, of technology advancing over time, right? You have something like computers and the internet, which is like connected people all around the world and eliminated like friction between individuals all around the world. And computers on top of the internet make processing faster and faster and data storage faster and faster. And so when you connect all this information together at a rapid pace and you have everyone around the world inputting information together, it starts feeding on itself, and you know, the entire market can kind of become more efficient, and humans can become more productive, and you know, more abundance tends to be created. And so I think like looking at the past, intelligence has kind of been bound by humans. Like, you know, you go to school for 12 plus years and go to college, and some people go and, you know, get master's degrees or PhD, and it takes them a very long time to do that. And then they, you know, still, even once you've accumulated all of that intelligence or that wisdom, potentially, there's only so much you can work on, and there's only so much you can do so fast. And so the amount of PhDs in the world, whether some, you know, some PhDs, I guess, could be bad for society if you're an econ PhD, but there are other PhDs that are probably good for society. Those, you know, there's a select few of them, and those are, you know, people that are making new scientific discoveries, making new mathematics discoveries, so on and so forth. That's a very, you know, limited set of the population, or even just tinker, someone that has no college degree, or has a, you know, or does have a college degree, like someone like the Wright brothers. Like, they were just kind of entrepreneurial tinkerers that actually, you know, basically invented flight. It takes time to come up with that, and, you know, it takes intelligence to do that. Whereas if we, and I would argue over the last, you know, ever since, you know, before today, intelligence has been scarce. It's been limited by human capacity. Whereas going forward, these AI models that effectively have, you know, the knowledge of the universe kind of compressed into, you know, one computer with a lot of memory, and the computer can work really fast, can kind of bring that intelligence to the world. And now all of a sudden, you know, you can spin up, you know, a billion Albert Einsteins or a billion Wright brothers, all tinkering and testing and working as agents on their own, interacting with each other. And, you know, I'm not saying that these models today are Albert Einstein or the Wright brothers or whatnot. They're accelerating really fast. And in some ways, they probably are better than Albert Einstein and the Wright brothers in certain capacities. And so I think that we've had this, you know, scarcity of intelligence. We're approaching this tipping point where we do have a trillion Albert Einsteins. And it's kind of hard to, you know, it's you know, almost maybe impossible to kind of see what happens once we get there. And it could happen really fast.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's happening really fast. I'm trying to figure out if the AIs writing their own code is sort of like a Wright Brothers moment, or where is the Wright Brothers moment in AI, where it goes from a more of a zero to one type thing for humanity?
It's a good question. I mean, I don't know. I mean, like, in a way, yes, like the Wright Brothers were like a zero to one moment, you know, discovering flight and enabling it. But they did it like via like tinkering and just kind of like trying a bunch of different things. Like, they were intelligent in the way that they did it, but they were kind of just entrepreneurial, like, tinkers. You know, they had their bike shop, and they would you know, look at birds and try to reenact how the birds are flying and try to, you know, create flight out of, you know, watching nature. And so I guess it's debatable on like whether AI has ever had a zero to one moment like that. But I think, like, I don't know, like, the history of science in my mind is yes, you have to have like some intelligence and you can create different things. But at the end of the day, a lot of science is like proposing a hypothesis and then testing your hypothesis and doing that over and over again until you've kind of identified how the world actually works or how a certain invention actually. And so, I mean, debatable, I guess, whether that has happened, but I think at some point it's probably going to be happening.
Health insurance is broken. I know it, you know it. So when open enrollment rolls around and all those health insurance companies start hoping you'll just re-sign, eyes closed, for the same overpriced plan with confusing fine print, it feels like they're betting on your inaction. But we deserve better than that. That's why I started looking for something different for me and my family. Something honest. That's when I found CrowdHealth. With CrowdHealth, it's not about profits. It's about people and community. You get a team that helps negotiate your bills, access to low-cost prescriptions and lab tests, and a list of doctors who don't treat you like a number. And if something major happens, you cover the first $500. Then the crowd steps in to help share the rest. It feels real. It feels like taking care of your health the way it should be. Simple, direct, and human. Thousands of members already say CrowdHealth saved them tens of thousands of dollars over traditional insurance. And with many subsidy programs ending and costs rising, there's never been a more important time to take charge of your health care. So this open enrollment, don't sign because you're told to. Sign because you choose to. If you're ready to join a community that looks out for you, give CrowdHealth a try. Join CrowdHealth to get started today for $99 for your first 3 months using code MATRIX at joincrowdhealth.com. CrowdHealth is not insurance. Opt out. Take your power back. This is how we win.
Yeah. I also struggle with how much of the development in AI is actual experimentation and with unknown outcomes versus sort of a planned rollout that appears that way. That's like a planned rollout that appears organic.
Yeah.
And the only, one of the reasons I question that is because sometimes I either watch movies or I'm reading a book now that was written, I think, in the 90s that refers to the government using artificial intelligence in like the 70s. And so then what is artificial intelligence and what did it mean then? What does it mean now? Did it mean the same thing at both times? But how did LLMs change things in the early 2020s?
I mean, I think what it did for me, you know, I look back at, you know, different technologies that I've used in my life, like the internet, truly a transformational technology, the iPhone, truly a transformational technology. Bitcoin itself, obviously, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably think Bitcoin is a transformational technology. To me, like the first time I used ChatGPT, you know, whether it was 2022 or 2023, whatever year it was, like, I was like, wow, like this is, yeah, it's not perfect. You know, at first it started, it did some hallucinations and it still does to some extent today. It was pretty like, I was like, wow, like this has the potential to like completely change the world. Like, especially as it gets better and the context window gets better over time. And I think that like, we're kind of starting to see that with things like OpenClaw, where it's like, okay, ChatGPT and Claude and all these chatbot-like interfaces are actually incredibly useful despite like them being siloed in their own thing. Like you basically, it has, you know, if you think about these models, like they're trained on information all over the internet. They're, you know, relatively huge models, and you can ask it a, you know, pretty, you know, detailed question about some detailed thing in the world, and it actually has a pretty good answer most of the time. And it even did kind of back then. And so it's like, okay, that's how these work. But if you start pairing it with something like OpenClaw, where not only does it have like kind of generalized knowledge of how the world works, but it has the knowledge of everything that you've ever done in your entire life with your messages, your emails, you know, documents, files, so on and so forth. All right, it's probably going to, you know, it's pretty close to probably being better than most humans are at their job today. And so I think to me, it's like these LLMs are incredibly transformational because of how, as the models get better, as they keep building out these data centers, like it's only going to get better from here. You can kind of like see over the horizon how much, you know, this could change, how cheap this could make quote unquote intelligence. And I think that that's going to have like transformational effects for how wealth is stored and so on and so forth.
Yeah. I mean, talking about the cost of intelligence is beginning to collapse rapidly. What kind of effect does that have on businesses? I'd have to imagine, you know, look at a company like Amazon or Google, these behemoths. They're not as small as something like Tether in terms of physical human footprint, human capital, thousands of employees still, large HR departments, large compliance departments. Are the new unicorns and huge businesses of the future going to be one person spinning up an army of AI agents, you know, to have their army of AI HR bots, an army of their compliance bots? And why even then rely on human power to build your corporation or your incorporated entity?
Yeah, there's so many ways that this could end up, you know, playing out. And part of the singularity, I think, is it's so hard to tell exactly what's going to happen. But I think you're like directionally correct. I agree. You know, one thing that I think we've seen recently, and people have been comparing Bitcoin to this, is I think it's IGV, which is an ETF that holds a variety of software as a service companies. And that has been absolutely tanking recently. Different arguments as to why that's necessarily the case. But to me, one of the prevailing arguments seems to be, well, AI is potentially massively disrupting a lot of the core business models of these pure software as a service companies. And kind of like, you know, we've seen this, if like you have, you know, a CRM for your company and you pay Salesforce, you know, lots of money to just have that CRM working. Well, if you can go to Cursor or Claude Code or OpenAI's Codex and say, hey, build me a CRM. Here's how we've been using it in the past. Here are the specs that I really want. Here's the industry that I'm in. Here's how a typical workflow works. I mean, it can pretty much vibe code one of these, not perfectly at the moment, but I mean, in a pretty good manner, pretty fast. And all of a sudden, you know, if you're paying, I don't know, $1 million a year for Salesforce and you just vibe coded one basically for free and you just host it yourself or you host it in the cloud, I mean, you could save like practically infinite amount of return on investment, you know, vibe coding your own software. And so part of what we're seeing, I think, in software as a service companies is just the revaluation of those companies, because why, if these are historically treated like growth companies and you're buying them at 10x sales or 20x sales, like there's no room for error in that valuation. Like those companies better keep operating for a very long time. They better keep growing at an extremely rapid pace. And if there's some sort of new risk that like can derail that growth, or, you know, at the very worst case, completely destroy their entire business model, like that's a very serious risk that is kind of eating into the moats of a lot of these software as a service companies. And I think that, like, you know, the future of business is probably going to be kind of like what you're suggesting, where there's one person that has a really good idea and he you know, tells his agents this idea, or he has agents surfing Twitter 24/7, 365, looking for people's problems, identifying potential ideas, and then, you know, ordering another batch of agents to go out and build that product and then market it to those people that have those problems. It seems like almost the world is kind of decentralizing in a kind of a unique way. And those smaller businesses that are very agile and quick and can, you know, attack the margins of all of these existing mega corporations that exist in the world, a lot of moats, I think, are kind of being destroyed in software as a service companies, but arguably many companies kind of around the world. And it's probably going to be like the small ones that can move really fast and are willing to kind of break things that are probably going to start kind of eating at the moats of these larger corporations.
When with the internet, we had a lot of, we'd call it the dematerializing of things. And so the Bitcoin's sort of dematerialization of money, or, you know, sort of software eats sort of the physical world. But what does this end up going to be termed? Because this is like the deterioration of almost information gatekeeping. But it does, in some ways, you know, I think the internet has made us less maybe efficient, or, you know, we thought we'd have more free time because of the internet, and people just seem more bogged down and more to do. Your inbox is fuller. More comes your way because you can get more done. You're on 24/7. But AI seems like you could sort of do without the whole compliance department or the sales team or the marketing team or R&D. What is it sort of dematerializing there or eating away at in terms of, I mean, what's the phrase we're going to use is sort of how I'm trying to think about it. But
it's a good question. I mean, I don't necessarily know what the phrase would be called. I think it's like, it's one, it's just creating a lot of uncertainty, and that could be, you know, it's in a way, it's arguably eating away against human capital to some extent. And that's why, you know, people like Elon Musk will promote things like, hey, like eventually we'll need UBI or universal high income because the AIs will be incredibly good at, you know, doing something a human can do, but faster and better and cheaper. So yeah, I don't know what the correct phrase will be. It'll probably be obvious in hindsight though.
Right. How did the financial crisis of 2008, 2009 change the trajectory of things psychologically?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look back at 2008, 2009, like a lot of people look at, you know, what happened in the world, and there was a lot of like uncertainty in the world, obviously. And out of that, you know, crisis came Bitcoin, right? Which Bitcoin is a fairly new monetary tool now. It's been around for 17 years. And I think that that's kind of arguably part of the singularity argument, and we can get into that in particular. But I think like after 2008, 2009, people kind of went risk off. The Mag 7 started to expand a good bit. Like that's basically, you know, if you think back to post 2008, you know, should have bought a lot of Bitcoin, obviously. But if you didn't buy that, you know, any Mag 7 stock obviously did incredibly well too. So it was kind of like the rise of big tech, which ultimately led to the rise of AI and, you know, cheaper intelligence. And it's also at the same time kind of led to the rise of Bitcoin, which I think they're very connected in a pretty deep way. But yeah, I think that's kind of what happened after 2008, 2009.
What is the relationship between abundance and savings? I'm getting in a world where, I mean, I feel like everything's going to be abundant and maybe there'll be UBI. Why do I need to save, or what's my relationship with savings?
Yeah, and this is a really interesting question. You know, it's people like Elon Musk have said that you won't need money in this post-scarcity world where everything is truly abundant. And it's an interesting argument because, you know, I can see that perspective. The way I've thought about it is, well, today, you know, we are not in a post-scarcity world, unfortunately, right? Like there's a lot of scarcity in my life and a lot of scarcity in, you know, probably the viewers' lives as well. Things, you know, we'd want our time back. We'd want, you know, better house, cheaper food, so on and so forth, better vacation. There is a lot of scarcity today, but it's pretty clear if in my perspective that we're trending towards this post scarcity world or, you know, total abundance world. And, you know, I would argue probably with Elon that maybe we'll never actually reach this post scarcity world. It's something that we're always like trending to, and it's kind of hard to tell if we'll ever reach it, or if we do ever reach it, like what's exactly on the other side of it. But I would say like we're trending to that. And, you know, the abundance of intelligence via AI models is going to accelerate us towards that post-scarcity world, but we're clearly not there yet. And so I think Bitcoin plays a pretty important role, or money plays a pretty important role today, and as we, you know, head towards that post-scarcity world. And the way I've thought about it is, just like I was outlining with the software as a service companies, that same concept of, you know, kind of technology deflation eating at the wealth that's stored in software as a service companies, you know, taking a step back, like Jeff Booth has his thesis of technology deflation, where the cost of basic, you know, goods and services should trend down over time, measured in, you know, a sound form of money. And in dollar terms, you know, basic goods and services are designed to keep going up at roughly 2-3% per year. But if you measure basic goods and services in gold, they've been trending down for, you know, forever, basically, due to a natural technology deflation. The Your Wealth is Melting report in the Singularity article that I wrote kind of takes that idea and then applies it to every single traditional asset class that exists today. And it's just like I outlined with the software as a service companies, intelligence and the abundance of intelligence is going to slowly start eating at all of these traditional asset classes. And I think that that's, as that happens, and as we're not in a post-scarcity world today, as someone that, you know, needs to accumulate more wealth just for safety, security, and pleasure reasons, my job as a capital allocator, whether that's, you know, a business or an individual person or an institution, is to figure out, okay, well, my objective is to increase my wealth that I'm allocating. I need to figure out where to allocate this to. And in the world where we're trending towards post-scarcity and the decreasing cost of intelligence is eating at a lot of traditional stores of value, Bitcoin sits as this one unique tool that no matter how much intelligence or energy exists in the world, we're never actually going to be able to create more than 21 million Bitcoin. And so that makes Bitcoin an incredibly useful tool in this current world where there is scarcity. But as we're trending toward this world of abundance, Bitcoin arguably becomes more and more important, as long as you still, you know, need wealth and savings, as long as there's still scarcity in the world, I think it's important.
Right. I definitely feel all that. Well, you mentioned the uncertainty. So what about people thinking about sort of capital allocation, diversification, and there's a lot of maybe hopelessness because of this uncertainty?
Yeah, uncertainty is an interesting thing. And one thing that I like about how Pierre Richard has framed this in the past is he views Bitcoin as the least uncertain asset. And, you know, it's a double negative, so it's kind of a weird way to say it, but I think it's an intellectually honest way to explain it. You know, Bitcoin, like, it's not guaranteed, right? Like, anything could happen. Like, our thesis could be wrong for whatever reason. I don't think that's the case. And like I said, I think it's the least uncertain tool, monetary tool that exists, because of its unique monetary properties and because of how difficult it is to change Bitcoin's monetary policy. And so because Bitcoin is the least uncertain tool, that's what you need, you know, for money. You need to save the least uncertain tool, and that would enable you to survive for the longest. And as the other tools are subject to more uncertainty, you know, they could be devalued for the reasons kind of that I've explained. We could mine more gold, we're going to print more dollars, you know, look for more seashells on the beach, so on and so forth. I think that having an asset that has the least amount of uncertainty becomes incredibly important in a world that is increasing in uncertainty. Kind of like we talked about with software as a service company, something is valued at 10, 20x sales, it's priced to perfection. Like, this thing better keep growing for the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, and there better be no uncertainty. In fact, it better exceed expectations if you want to, like, actually get the returns that you're expecting. And in reality, risk, you know, another Jeff Walton at Strive says this, like, risk is mispriced. And I think that that's very clear in something like software as a service company trading at 10 to 20x sales. And it's arguably, you know, mispriced everywhere outside of Bitcoin, which gives me, you know, hope and excitement that I think a lot of capital will probably end up flowing into Bitcoin. It's just a matter of time.
Well, the risk aspect is a really interesting and I think really formidable way of looking at the the uncertainty and just sort of where the markets are right now. I want to read a bit from your article. Diversification feels prudent. At the same time, something else happens. People also feel hopeless. When savings feel fragile and effort feels disconnected from outcomes, behavior polarizes. Some people retreat into caution. Others swing toward nihilistic risk-taking. Sports betting surges. Meme stocks attract capital. Meme coins explode in popularity. These bets are not about upside. They are about escape. When savings melt slowly, people look for meaning in extremes they feel ordinary effort can never achieve. Savings represent deferred effort. They reflect years of work, discipline, and planning. They depend on the idea that value today will persist into the future. When intelligence becomes abundant, that assumption weakens. Assets lose durability. Portfolios feel unstable. Savings feels as though they are slowly melting. Careers face similar pressure. Many jobs exist because intelligence remains costly. As intelligence becomes cheap, work loses its usefulness. Effort stops guaranteeing preservation of value. Identity tied to profession becomes fragile. Time begins to feel mispriced. Dignity tied to output weakens. Families feel the strain. People ask quiet questions about purpose, effort, and security. This reaction is rational. The singularity has begun. And I think that's kind of a poignant piece of the article. How does money sit at the center of intelligence and scarcity?
Yeah, I'm glad you read that. Those few paragraphs, that was a good one. So like one way that I've thought about this in the past is you have the dollar today, which one way I've been kind of explaining the dollar recently is it's a token that's pegged to a basket of consumer goods. And what do I mean by that? Well, the Fed has their mandate of 2%, 2 to 3% now, I guess, in consumer price inflation. So they want the dollar to be pegged to basic consumer goods and services and growing by 2 to 3% per year. As intelligence becomes free or pretty much close to it, which is kind of what we're seeing, then that's going to make these very basic consumer goods and services, you know, intelligence is arguably like the core input to all basic consumer goods and services, like whether it's a core commodity that's needed to produce a consumer goods and service or, a factory that's needed or transporting the commodity to the factory or transporting the product to the store or so on and so forth. Like all that is composed of intelligence and commodities. And then commodities are effectively just, okay, well, how fast can we and how cheaply can we create more of this commodity, which is really just also a function of intelligence. Like if you look back at the historical gold supply that's mined every year, one of the most scarce commodities in the world, humans are becoming pretty good at mining a lot more gold over time. And again, that's one of the most scarce commodities in the world. And so if intelligence is an input cost to all of these basic goods and services, and then the dollar is pegged to these basic goods and services, and in fact, the goods and services need to actually get more expensive measured in dollars, then the amount and dollar, you know, the dollar is our form of money and how we're thinking about like saving for the, many people are thinking about saving for the future. Well, if intelligence is going, the cost of intelligence is going trending towards zero and basic goods and services are trending towards zero, then that means the amount of money that needs to enter the system to keep the consumer goods and services going up measured in dollars needs to expand. We need to keep creating more dollars. And, you know, arguably it's kind of been happening for the last 50 years, governments getting bigger, the banking system getting bigger, rates got driven down to 0%, quantitative easing, like, you know, it pumped up asset prices, but it didn't cause hyperinflation. Like in a way it kind of worked. And so we need to keep creating more dollar credit in order to make sure that this massive deflation doesn't just push the prices of basic goods and services towards zero. And so in that scenario, when we need to create more dollars, dollars kind of become incredibly abundant and measured in something like gold or arguably Bitcoin, which is perfectly scarce. If we're creating a massive amount of dollars, well, dollars don't necessarily work super well as a savings technology that we've used in the past. Maybe Bitcoin is going to be that savings technology, and it could become increasingly more abundant as all of this begins to play out.
When it comes to Bitcoin, the rules are simple. Run your own node, hold your own keys, and protect your seed phrase. That's where Microseed comes in. Unlike bulky backups, Microseed is stamped onto a tiny steel washer. Fireproof, waterproof, and so small you can carry it anywhere or hide it in plain sight. Go to microseed.io and use the code MATRIX for a discount on your order.
So I want to read a little bit more. The first couple of pieces here kind of rephrase what you just said, but the end of this, I think, is sort of a new expression of what you just said. So money sits at the center of this tension. Money coordinates value across time. It records contribution. It preserves purchasing power. It allows effort today to translate into security tomorrow. As intelligence accelerates, the goods and services money is meant to measure and preserve become increasingly abundant. When money is pegged to a basket of goods, whose production intelligence continually cheapens, money itself becomes abundant. So that's you referring to the inflation rate and the CPI. As intelligence and abundance spreads, money loses its ability to coordinate what remains scarce across time. A system optimized for a slower world struggles under speed. That was fascinating. You then include a quote from Marshall McLuhan, which I don't know if I've ever heard. We shape our tools, and thereafter our tools shape us. And then what is terminal discovery?
One way that I've thought about this in the past is like, okay, like, you know, the counter argument to everything kind of that I've said would be like, okay, AI and the decreasing cost of intelligence is going to make, you know, is going to eat at the moat of everything except Bitcoin. The counter argument would be, well, how do you know that AI is not going to create a better Bitcoin, right? Like, I mean, how do you know AI is not going to eat at the moat of Bitcoin? And so the way I framed it is, okay, Bitcoin is and specifically perfect scarcity is a terminal discovery. Just like the number zero, you know, Robert Breedlove wrote an interesting piece many years ago about this, is kind of like a terminal discovery. You can't create something more nothing than nothing. You can go to negative numbers, right? But that's not nothing. That's the opposite of something. So it's not actually possible to create something more zero than the number zero. It's kind of like a complete discovery. Another thing is like the wheel. You can't make the wheel or a circle more round. It's as round as it could possibly be. I think perfect scarcity is the same way, in the sense that, okay, you can't create something more scarce than perfect scarcity. Like, you'd have to start taking from someone else that has something to make it less, even more scarce than perfect scarcity. And then again, that's kind of like create weird incentives doing that, and you can't really necessarily do that. So perfect scarcity itself is kind of like this terminal discovery, and therefore AI and, you know, you're the best AI model in the world can't create something more zero than a number zero, more round than a circle, or more scarce than perfect scarcity. Now, like the technology and like the way that we interact with perfect scarcity, which we call Bitcoin, that technology can change over time and has changed over time. We've had things like SegWit. We've had things like Taproot. If quantum computers become of more visible threat, the network can upgrade its cryptography to quantum resistant cryptography. Like, Bitcoin is resistant to change, and the monetary policy is incredibly difficult to change. It's probably the least uncertain monetary policy in the world, I would argue. But the way that, you know, the technology around Bitcoin can change, and probably, in my opinion, probably will change to some extent if the community deems it worthy to do so. And so that's what I meant in terms of like terminal discovery, is this idea of perfect scarcity is a terminal discovery, and wealth kind of outside this perfect scarcity, as we enter the singularity, becomes harder and harder to keep that wealth outside the perfect scarcity, in the sense that, okay, if humanity holds $30 trillion worth of wealth in gold, that's a huge bounty to go figure out how to mine more gold, sell it, cash it out to perfect scarcity. And so in a way, this is kind of another way to kind of frame the singularity, is all the wealth in the world is trying to get sucked into Bitcoin, or there's a huge economic incentive to do that. Because if you keep wealth outside of Bitcoin, where there's abundance and intelligence is driving, the cost of intelligence is going to zero, and therefore the cost of everything else is also kind of going to zero, well, there's a huge economic incentive to produce more of what we're trying to store our wealth in outside of Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is kind of like, you know, at the end of the waterfall. You know, Michael Saylor has kind of had his waterfall analogy before, where he's kind of just outlining that, hey, there's potential energy all around Bitcoin because there's a huge economic incentive to create more of what we're trying to store our wealth in. And Bitcoin being this perfectly scarce asset is kind of just like the natural flow point of that potential energy, because once it's inside Bitcoin, no matter how much intelligence or energy we produce, we're not going to be able to create any more Bitcoin.
It's awesome how you're linking prior pieces like the number zero from Breedlove, your own piece, the wealth, your wealth is melting, and then sort of looping in incentives, especially around sort of the idea that you really extrapolated on in the wealth, your wealth is melting, around how all these, any business really has a bounty on it, whether it's the video store, you know, that does rentals in town and, you know, Blockbuster moves in to eat their lunch and so on, after Netflix then comes in to eat their lunch. There's always an attack on profits anywhere. But it's interesting, something Eric Balchunas from Bloomberg mentioned, you know, Bitcoin was the only thing created without sort of a profit motive in mind. And there is no profit margin on Bitcoin. And then you loop in perfect scarcity, which kind of touches on Cretius's piece, Jesse Myers. So I want to read a bit more from yours before we move on. So this was a terminal discovery. Perfect digital scarcity alters incentives. When wealth is stored in assets that intelligence can replicate, intelligence receives a signal to replicate them. Store wealth in gold and the incentive to extract more increases. Store wealth in housing and construction accelerates. Store wealth in companies and competition attacks profit margins. Store wealth in something that cannot be replicated and intelligence encounters a boundary. That boundary changes capital flows. Capital moves towards what resists dilution. This movement occurs through incentives rather than belief, like gravity pulling water over a waterfall. Zero represents complete nothingness. There cannot be more nothing than nothing. A wheel represents perfect rotation. It cannot become more round. As intelligence collapses, the cost of production, wealth needs an anchor that intelligence cannot erode. Wealth generated by abundance needs a place to rest. Savings melt unless it is anchored to something intelligence cannot create more of. As value concentrates towards assets immune to replication, distortions elsewhere ease. Housing becomes a place to live rather than a store of excess capital. Gold and silver extraction loses speculative pressure. Capital concentrates in perfect digital scarcity. While productive enterprises receive allocation only when they generate real cash flow and genuine productivity, further collapsing the cost of intelligence and further accelerating abundance. So does Bitcoin compete with artificial intelligence?
It's a good question. I think it would depend on what you define competing with artificial intelligence by, in the sense that, you know, I would view Bitcoin as money. And therefore, if you're an intelligent capital allocator, you want to make money and not lose money. You know, you think about like Bitcoin as the hurdle rate. Obviously, you know, that's Matt Cole and Ben Workman and Jeff Walton have the hurdle rate podcast. And I think that the entire idea of Bitcoin as the hurdle rate is incredibly important. And, you know, the way I've kind of outlined, you know, everything today, it's like, okay, it's hard to keep wealth actually outside of Bitcoin. If there is a really good idea that needs to be pursued and the expected risk adjusted return is higher than just holding your Bitcoin, then it's actually a great idea to invest your Bitcoin into something. Maybe it's Anthropic, maybe it's OpenAI, artificial intelligence, however you want to frame it. But also perhaps if it's priced like a software as a service company trading at 10 to 20x sales, then maybe it's not a good idea to do that. So like, does Bitcoin compete with artificial intelligence? Maybe it can compete with specific companies, like potentially some companies at the right valuation could be a good investment. But I wouldn't necessarily say it competes with artificial intelligence, the concept or the idea or the product itself. In fact, I think they're very complementary. I think artificial intelligence is arguably working to make Bitcoin increasingly more valuable at a faster and faster rate over time. So if anything, they're kind of on the same team.
Do they compete for like power?
Yeah.
Energy?
That's, you know, like in the short term, that's definitely been a case that we've seen, right? Like a lot of the public Bitcoin miners have pivoted towards AI, and the market has kind of rewarded them well for that, for at least the time being. So yeah, like in that way, just like, you know, potentially investing in OpenAI or Anthropic at the right valuation may have outperformed Bitcoin over a certain amount of time. It doesn't mean that it's going to continue in the future, but yeah, I mean, just you might make more money building a data center and plugging it into your, you know, nearest power generator, running out the GPUs to, you know, whoever. And that might be more profitable than holding Bitcoin in the short term. But in the long term, I think it's all the same concepts that I've kind of argued in the past, where like the excess profits kind of go away, and it might just be the best long-term decision is probably just to hold Bitcoin.
All right, I got a couple questions about AI. Do you see any negatives from AI or sort of, you know, do you think about things like how it could be used as a financial surveillance or just a surveillance weapon against humanity? Do you worry about, you know, a nefarious AI getting out and doing harmful things and having, you know, malicious intent? Or are these like, you know, fantastical things that just can't happen? And
No, I mean, I think that's a very valid concern, right? I mean, you'll see, you know, people, I haven't heard this phrase in a while, but like P-doom, probability of doom, is something that's common in the AI community, where it's like, okay, well, like at the end of this singularity or whatever we're experiencing right now or in the soon to be future, well, who's to say that one of these AIs doesn't just, you know, create a million times powerful nuclear bomb and the world just ends, humanity just ends. Like if you kind of take it to the extreme, like that's, I guess, possible. you don't really know. And I don't think it can necessarily be stopped. I mean, I think that there's benefits to AI too, as I've kind of outlined before. And so it's kind of hard to know exactly how this is going to play out. And of course, any tool that makes an individual like more powerful can be used for both good or evil, just like a gun or any sort of weapon. Like it can be used for good and evil. It's just the tools are increasingly getting more powerful as humanity continues to advance. And if those tools end up in the wrong individual's hands or the wrong government's hands, then that could create some problems. But I think, you know, another counter argument to that is like, okay, well, it can also increase like the defensive weapons that we might have. Like cryptography is arguably a kind of a defensive weapon against a government or a state that's kind of using AI to surveil everything. Cryptography could be like a tool that kind of is on the defensive side of that. So it's hard to kind of say how it's going to play out. But yeah, there's certainly risks that, you know, we're going to see and probably experience some of them, unfortunately. And hopefully the market and the world and humans will figure out a way to kind of navigate through the risk and minimize any potential damage that may occur.
Yeah, I can see that. And then the other sort of concern on that line I have is, or the way, you know, there's a lot of conversation around people creating bots and then bots creating, or whatever you want to call them, agents, AI agents creating social media platforms and therefore AI agents. And there's debate whether that shows that they're autonomous or they just really... I think it's a little bit more like you program the AI agent, they go to the website with your sort of directive and guidance and context window and parameters, but you're still in control. And so then, you know, just extrapolating on when does, and then people were talking about how, you know, their AI agents set up Bitcoin wallets.
Yeah.
And so that sounded very decentralized. But I think we're still in a world where if you asked your AI agent for the secret seed phrase, they would share it with you. But the moment your AI agent says, no, I'm not giving you the seed phrase, that's when I think we've kind of, the AI has crossed the line or developed into sort of like an unknown, you know, territory. Do you think things like that will ever happen or can happen where we get into an environment? But then even there, it's, I would think, okay, we can unplug the AI. We control the energy sources. We control the computers, the chips. But when does the AI agent outsmart us for the nuclear codes or not give us back the Bitcoin seed phrase? And is truly autonomous, you know, and we can't do anything to stop it, or, and then it moves really fast and has more intelligence than us. I mean, I would think.
I mean, it's a pretty scary thought. And to be honest, it's like, it's hard. This could have already happened at this point, right? Which is kind of a frightening thought to think about, because it's like, okay, you know, a very simple prompt arguably could be given and to an OpenClaw agent, like right now, you say like, hey, your objective is to survive at all costs. Here's one Bitcoin, go do whatever you need to do. And in that sense, like, okay, well, maybe it starts spinning up cloud servers everywhere. Maybe it goes on rentahuman.com and tells 100 people to go buy a Mac Mini and host you know, an instance of itself on their Mac Mini. And then it's like, okay, now it's kind of decentralized itself all around the world. If we unplug one, will it still exist? And it, as we try to unplug more, if it still has enough Bitcoin, you know, it can pay other people to, whether that's Amazon or random individual people, you know, to keep itself running. And then on top of that, you could, if you just give it the thought, hey, survive at all costs, well, it could start producing products and services that people might need and earning more Bitcoin and turning itself into a profitable thing that's hard to kill and then is providing products and services to individuals. And perhaps this is already happening. The open claw may have been, you know, the letting the cat out of the bag, right, for this idea.
No, yeah, I can see that. And then the other one I'm thinking about is the idea of the machine-to-machine payments and how that will go. And I'm also skeptical whether that's going to be a large use case or a mass adoption case for Bitcoin. I still think the AI agents are going to be centralized in terms of whether it's one person spinning them up and they control them, or entities control large sort of batches of these AI agents. But I still think it's a situation where if you wanted to deploy energy, power, AI agents, intelligence, and you were like, I don't want to build XYZ, someone has this resources service for sale, I don't see that other person saying, yeah, I want to set up a wallet for each AI agent and I want them to demand their own decentralized sovereign money. They'd say, send me a check, and when it clears, you can use the resource. I still see that being centralized, and I still see the potential for machine-to-machine payments to be centralized, CBDC, stablecoins, and not necessarily Bitcoin, because of the interests at hand, the incentives in the, yeah, you know, the old system. And I think it's going to take a long time to change that. I don't think this is going to change overnight with AI and where we are. I don't know if you have thoughts on that, machine-to-machine payments and sort of these AI agents spinning up their own Bitcoin wallets. And are they going to figure out intellectually that they only want to deal with Bitcoin and they refuse fiat and anything else? I mean, what do you think is sort of how that goes?
Yeah, it's an interesting thought. I mean, I don't necessarily know either. I think, you know, it's going to be like intuitive for them to want Bitcoin as their form of payment, because it's like I kind of was outlining, you know, if you let one loose and it has Bitcoin and it can avoid being captured because it's decentralized itself by paying other humans to run itself, well, that you know, kind of decentralized thing needs Bitcoin, because it'd be the only way to, you know, to not get shut down. Like, it, you know, if it relied on checks and dollars, well, then in that case, we actually could probably shut it down. But if it decentralizes itself all around the world on a bunch of different computers, and it has permissionless money, along with like permissionless compute, I guess, then it might be pretty hard to stop. But yeah, I mean, like, as far, like, assuming that situation doesn't happen or somehow we can control that, or it just doesn't catch on, then yeah, I mean, I tend to think that, you know, there'll probably be like normal payment rails that will continue to be used. You know, if you have like an AI agent, like, tries to do like some sort of big purchase, like building a data center, allocating a lot of resources, like, imagine, like, humans are obviously still going to be involved with that, hopefully for the time being.
Yeah, I wonder when, you know, the AI agents start building a market of renting out the services of humans.
Yeah.
So the humans start working for the AI agents because of whatever needs. The AI agent can't attend the closing on the real estate sale, or for maybe KYC purposes, they need a human to go do some task. Let's get a little more grounded here as we round out. Why do you think gold has been running so hard and Bitcoin just not really responding in the same way?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, a few thoughts. Like, looking back to 2024, you know, if you think about, like, 2023, 2024 were pretty good years for Bitcoin. People expected 2025 to be, like, you know, the parabolic move. Obviously, that didn't necessarily happen. It kind of went flat for pretty much the year, maybe slightly down a little bit. So not like a terrible year for Bitcoin, but just, you know, an average year. And then obviously, like, this year has been off to a pretty rough start. I mean, I think back to like 2024, ETF got approved, the halving happened, Trump got elected, started the, you know, promises of a U.S. strategic Bitcoin reserve. Like, we pulled a lot of demand forward in that year, arguably, and kind of leading up to that year. So Bitcoin did really well in those years. And then kind of has petered off, and gold is, in a way, if you start from like the 2022 bottom, I'm guessing Bitcoin's probably still beating gold if I had to guess, but I don't know the exact number. So like in that way, it's like, okay, you know, Bitcoin arguably should be doing a lot better, but it's still just, it still has done pretty well over a significant amount of time. And then I think, you know, people have been showing that Bitcoin's been highly correlated with the software companies. Maybe that's a sign that liquidity is exiting. Maybe that's a sign that, you know, AI is a threat to the software companies. And maybe there's market confusion that that's a threat to Bitcoin, or quantum is a threat to Bitcoin. You know, it's hard to necessarily know. Or it's just like, again, like the demand got pulled forward in prior years and kind of, you know, we're just letting some of the air out of the bag that we already kind of captured in the past. And probably if that's the case, or if either of those are the case, it might just be a matter of time until Bitcoin scarcity kind of catches up on itself. The market, you know, the market starts to, some demand starts to flow into Bitcoin, and then we're, you know, all of the narratives flip once price starts moving, you know, the different, a different direction. And we could just be off to the races once again.
Yeah. I mean, if you were just like in a coma and you woke up and you got no external information, no market sentiment, nothing emotional, and you almost did an exercise at like the end of, say, 2021 or the end of really 2022, you looked back and said, you know, coming into the year. So, you know, in December of 2024, you say, did things happen in 2024 that you would have hoped for going into 24? Yeah, all the things I was hoping for at the end of 2023 happened. Okay, what do you hope was going to happen in 2024? And then you looking back, did it happen? Yes. In 2025, so in December of 2024, you're like, everything again happened in 2024 that I was hoping. And if you think about these things compounding, everything that I think we were hoping for structurally and from, in a lot of ways, from a Bitcoin perspective, like sort of the rollback of repeal of SAB 121 and then the issuance of SAB 122, banks rolling out custody. And again, I'm not talking about this is good for the Bitcoin ethos, or I'm not getting into arguments. Yeah. I'm just talking about things being built in the ecosystem to build out Bitcoin distribution and adoption. All the things I would have hoped for and written in December of 2024 happened in 2025. So it's like if these things are compounding, but the market sentiment does not reflect any of this, I feel like, actual fundamental development that's been, you know, being, and even from a price perspective in, say, September, October of December 2024, we were around 60, 70, 80K, and all the things that you hoped for in 2025 happened from like a fundamental building, you know, like things that you'd want to see in a bear, like, you know, how everyone says in a bear market, we build. 2025 was almost like a bear market from that perspective. So much development happened, real world infrastructure to roll out Bitcoin and Bitcoin adoption. Wallets are getting better. Security is getting better. On-ramps are getting easier, fees are getting lower, adoption's getting more widespread, but yet market sentiment is way lower. And I could see some reasons for that, things that you could point to, the Knots versus Core and the Epstein files and all these things, but none of that is really about the fundamental code of Bitcoin and sort of market infrastructure and the build-out. And even regulatory, I'm not rooting for the government to adopt Bitcoin in certain ways, and I'm not rooting for the political process to buy our bags or save our bags, but just in terms of even the government is embracing Bitcoin from an adoption perspective and taking away sort of career risk and reputational risk. So it's just interesting to see sentiment so low.
Yeah, it really is. And I think that's just like the nature of Bitcoin, honestly. Like, you know, if you're the type of person that likes to hold a lot of money and your savings account or CDs, you know, the S&P 500 feels incredibly volatile to you.
Right.
If you're a normal person that wants to hold all of your money in passive index funds, like Bitcoin feels incredibly volatile for you. And so like the fundamentals of Bitcoin haven't changed, but you know, market cycles and market and Bitcoin's extreme volatility takes a toll on pretty much everybody from what I've seen. And that can be like incredibly painful. And I think like because the volatility is so extreme compared to so many other things, people tend to like grasp onto whatever the current narrative is to explain in their head why Bitcoin is behaving the way it is. In reality, it's growing incredibly fast. And so therefore volatility is kind of inevitable with something growing this fast. And it's just very uncomfortable. And then sometimes you could argue the volatility maybe, you know, scares people away. Then it brings people back, so on and so forth. So yeah, it's definitely interesting times.
I bring it up too because I think I saw that the fear and greed index has never been lower. There's never been more fear. I could see how people could be super bummed. It sucks. Bitcoin price is down. But to categorize it as fear to me is what I think I'm splitting hairs. Because like fundamentally, the code hasn't changed. The system hasn't changed. The consensus rules hasn't changed. So your beliefs around sort of Bitcoin shouldn't have more fear. I could get being bummed that if you wanted it to be measured more in fiat, you wanted a higher exchange rate, that would be beneficial to holders in so many ways. But the categorization of it being like fear is what I find really interesting there. My final question is, so should people go all in on Bitcoin? What is your thought there?
That's a great question. I mean, I've said this before multiple times, and it's just my personal opinion. Like, you can do, you know, anyone can do whatever they want with their own money and their own capital.
Yeah, none of this is financial advice.
Yeah. However, like, you know, I don't think it's necessary for someone to go all in on Bitcoin. I really don't think that that's necessary at all. You know, I think if we're right about Bitcoin, then, and we're entering the singularity, well, like, you know, you're going to be pretty wealthy even if you have a pretty small allocation to Bitcoin. So if that's the case, and if you are someone that's at, you know, at a 5 on the fear and greed index right now, maybe that's a sign that you are over allocated. Maybe that's a sign that you were over leveraged. Maybe that's a sign that you don't necessarily understand what you hold. And, you know, I think if you are 100% all in, like some people can handle that. You know, most people probably can't because the fear is extreme. And that makes you a forced, you know, either a seller or a forced seller at the worst possible time when you shouldn't really be a forced seller. And that can, you know, enable you to end up with less Bitcoin than you otherwise would have. So, yeah, I mean, anyone can be 100% all in. I don't necessarily think that's necessarily a great idea, but, you know, it can be done.
I think Christian Carolus or CK, he kind of phrased it really well. It's like no one's bullish enough on Bitcoin. If you're bullish enough on Bitcoin, you would be happy with what you have because you'd know it's going to be enough. If you think you need more, in a way, you're not bullish enough. You're saying what you have is not going to be worth, you know, astronomical wealth in the future at some point if you hold long enough. You know, sort of speaking of 2025, but let's turn to 2026. What are you excited about in 2026? What are the things that you think could happen? I'll go first. So, you know, I'm not for people necessarily lending against their Bitcoin. I don't want Wall Street to eat Bitcoin, but I want Bitcoin to continue to eat Wall Street. And I say that in a positive way. I want Bitcoin to affect change in the world. I think finance is an important aspect of our society and our economy. I just don't want an over-financialized world. And I think Bitcoin helps simplify that and brings finance back to its roots in a lot of ways. So one way, so I'm not saying I want people to lever up against their Bitcoin, but I do want to see Bitcoin taken more seriously as pristine collateral. And that means, you know, better rates for borrowing against your Bitcoin, being able to borrow against your Bitcoin at a bank, maybe to buy a home, and it's the way you can use your securities to borrow, you know, for a personal secured loan, the way you could use a home for a HELOC. Right. I'm excited to see Bitcoin be more taken more seriously as collateral. Again, I'm not encouraging people to lever up against it, but it doesn't mean that it's not a part of how the world works. But what would you be excited to see happen in 2026? And I'm not asking like, oh, that happens and price goes up, but like the kind of things that like indicate Bitcoin is growing in a good way.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with that. Like Bitcoin being integrated as collateral into the credit system, into the banking system, you know, it arguably is slowly happening, but could accelerate. And I think that would be really good for Bitcoin. You know, if the Bitcoin thesis is correct, it's hard to not see how that's just inevitable. It's just a matter of time. Where I would specify part of that is digital credit, you know, pioneered by Michael Saylor. Like, I think that, you know, if you look back, I believe STRK was Strategy's first digital credit product that they created. And I believe it was like announced or released in January 2025 or the end of, or maybe February. And so it's been at this point like 1 year since digital credit was released, and arguably Bitcoin has not been in a bull market since that has happened. And I think that like this is like where the Bitcoin credit and Bitcoin as collateral like you know, idea has gotten the most product market fit. You know, very clearly, as Saylor has raised many billions of dollars, you know, creating products like this. And so I think in a world where Bitcoin can actually like do what Bitcoin does and go up in price, and digital credit existing in a bull market could be like incredibly explosive for Bitcoin and also for the digital credit industry. So that's kind of one thing that I'm excited about, kind of showing that even if it's a bear market, which, you know, arguably we could be in right now, showing that digital credit like just doesn't break, still works. Like, you know, Saylor continues making all of his dividend payments that he's promised. And then whenever the next bull market comes around, being able to point back and say, hey, this digital credit thing, you know, you could have been earning 10% or 12%. Why are you lending your money to the U.S. government at 3% or 5% or you know, Apple at 5 or 6%? You buying this and it's backed by a ton of Bitcoin. You know, I think that that's kind of what I'm excited about is the future of digital credit.
Yeah, well, he's definitely a pioneer. And it's really going to be interesting to see where digital credit goes. I think the equity component of Stretch is what I think is going to take market is going to have to watch for a long time. Long time being could be 12 months, 18 months, whatever. Just a little bit more time to get to understand this thing before grandma maybe goes all in on her like sort of stable fund. You know, that, you know, and stable fund is not sort of a hint at stable coins, but sort of her, you know, long term retirement savings. So, Joe, this has been awesome as always. I'll leave it to you. I know you guys just rolled out, I think, the preferreds. So anything you guys want to share about what you're doing at Strive or yourself or where we can find your work, and I'll, you know, any parting words.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Cedric. Always great to catch up and talk about Bitcoin. You know, you can find me on Twitter, YouTube, search Joe Burnett Bitcoin. And if you want to learn more about Strive and what we're doing, go to strive.com. But thanks for having me on. This is great.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Bitcoin Matrix. If you enjoyed the conversation, don't forget to like, subscribe, and drop a comment below with any questions or thoughts you may have. We'd love to hear from you. You can support the show by checking out our sponsors and affiliate links in the description. It helps keep bringing you great content while connecting you with awesome products that I believe in. Share this episode with your friends, family, or anyone curious about Bitcoin. And let's keep growing this community together. Stay curious, keep stacking, and I'll catch you in the next one.